It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Well, children are often under tremendous pressure to succeed in today's hyper-competitive society.
Besides coping with daily schoolwork, kids sometimes run from one special class to the next, constantly fast-tracked to excel at younger ages.
But there's a growing movement to slow down the pace of learning and allow kids to develop in all areas of their lives. Waldorf schools have developed their curriculum around the idea of slow learning. Today we ask how slow learning can still prepare students for the demands of an info-driven world.
Our guest today is Eric Utney, the founder of Utney Magazine and Nobel Prize Board Emeritus member. Utney's been involved with Waldorf education for over 35 years as a parent, a teacher, and a public advocate. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. It's good to be here.
In 2000, you left your post at the Utney Reader, the bimonthly magazine that you founded 30 years ago. Why did you leave?
Well, I had been both editing and publishing it for about 16 years, and I was burned out, and I was looking for some way to kind of get my hands dirty. And my kids' Waldorf school lost a teacher, and they asked me to pick up the seventh grade class. And I said, no way. And then 5 days later, I came back to them, and I said, well, if you'd have me, I'd love to do it.
That's a pretty big switch, yeah.
Myself being the class teacher in an urban Waldorf school.
And did you need an education degree, or is that something that's particular to Waldorf?
No, there's nowhere near enough Waldorf schools for the need, or Waldorf teachers for the need. And so, like many, I was pressed into service. I went through three intensive programs that summer, and I had a mentor, and I had my children's essays and main lesson books, and I'd stay up till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning a couple nights a week trying to stay a half step ahead of my students. Hmm. Somehow managed to do it.
And one of the things you did was you reread a book you tried to read earlier about Waldorf philosophy. What hit you about it that second time around?
That was a book by Rudolf Steiner called Knowledge of Higher Worlds, and it was very abstract philosophy the first time I read it. And the second time, somehow it just spoke to me. It talked about not just approaching life from the head, but also from the heart. And I knew I needed to do that. I'd been in the head business, publishing and editing a magazine for years. And teachers, if they're going to be effective in classroom management and connecting with kids, have to be more than just operating from their head. So this was an opportunity to kind of learn and redeem myself.
What does it mean to teach from the heart and to have an education system that's heart-based?
Well, it's head and heart. It's not just heart-based. It's Waldorf approaches academics through the arts. So every subject is taught through the arts, and children make their own main lesson books. They everything from science to math to history and creative writing, it's all done through the arts. So it's not just, you know, art where you paint or draw or learn music, which is also in the curriculum, but the academic subjects are also taught through the arts.
Now, I've heard you describe the style at Waldorf as slow teaching. Can you talk about what that means?
Yeah, one of the things that makes Waldorf unique, although lots of other people are catching on to it these days, is that it's age appropriate. So subjects are introduced to the children when they're ready for them rather than pushing them too early, especially reading and math. So Waldorf starts teaching reading as early as other schools, but in a different way, by reading to them and telling stories and having the kids really cultivate their imaginations and learning the letters with their bodies before they try to recognize abstract letters and put them together in words. So it's a very different approach, but it's catching on. In fact, in China in the last 10 years, Waldorf has exploded. There are 300 kindergartens in China now. and 20 schools and 2,000 teachers being trained to be Waldorf teachers. And in Norway, Waldorf has been there since the 1920s, and there are 28 Waldorf schools. If there were as many Waldorf schools per the population in Wisconsin as there are in Norway, there would be over 30 Waldorf schools in Wisconsin and over 2,000 in the U.S. And the prime minister is a Waldorf grad. The crown princess sends her kids to Waldorf schools. I mean, it's very much a part of the mainstream in Norway.
Is social justice part of the Waldorf mandate?
Well, it is because children are so important and education is so important. And for me, that was part of my motivation. We're robbing our children of their childhoods by pushing them to grow up and to succeed and to compete so soon, instead of allowing them to learn through play and through developing their imaginations, which is the way they really learn.
Well, let's talk a little more about slow learning and as it's embodied by the Waldorf method. How does it differ from, say, a public school today, where I guess, you know, for reading, kids would in kindergarten be learning their letters, practicing penmanship, starting beginning reading and putting sounds together, for example? How is Waldorf different?
Well, I have four sons who are all Waldorf educated, and they none of them learn to read until they're seven, and one of them until he's eight. And yet, all of them now are good writers. They love books. They went to college. Two of them are involved in the computer industry. They're all sort of social entrepreneurs. They care about the world, and they're involved in it. And that's, I know countless Waldorf kids like that. So anecdotally, I can speak to it. And there have been studies, too, about what happens to Waldorf kids after graduation. And they tend to get in the colleges of their choice. Lots of them become involved in social services or teachers or foresters or medical professions. So it's they seem to turn out, even though many of them, you know, weren't reading as early as kids in public school. Kids will learn to read at an early age. And, in fact, the U.S. Kids read earlier than most other countries, but by eighth grade, we're way behind in terms of both reading ability and especially the love of reading. And there was this study that the New York Times reported where 40% of college grads don't read a book after college graduation. So learning to read early doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to learn to love to read.
That's interesting, because I imagine a lot of parents would hear that they're children in Waldorf would start to learn at age 7 or 8, and if their children were doing that, they'd be worried, saying, you know, Johnny's falling behind. All the other kids are reading in kindergarten already. But you're saying that there's a different kind of learning, it sounds like, that happens prior to making that big leap.
Well, they're learning in so many other ways in those early ages. They're learning, you know, to really be in their bodies. In Waldorf schools, it's we talk about head, hands, and heart. They're learning to knit and do counting games and beanbag tossing games and balance beam and other things where they're really learning to kind of become coordinated. They're learning to take a delight in nature. They're out in nature almost 2 hours a day. I mean, they have real recess. Lots of games, movement games. They learn so much through movement. And a lot of that has been cut out of the public school curriculum for budget reasons. And, you know, it's a real tragedy.
We're talking now with Eric Utney, founder of Utney Magazine. He's also a Waldorf teacher, a parent, and a public advocate, talking about the concept of slow learning that goes hand in hand, he's saying, with Waldorf schools.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's too much pressure on kids to learn academics early, reading and math? Should we slow things down a little bit? Or do you see value in pushing reading and math at an earlier age? What do you think of, or what do you want to know about Waldorf as a teaching method and how it compares to education in the rest of the country? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation after this look at the headlines with Kristen Durst. Welcome back to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Eric Utney, founder of Utney Magazine. He is a Waldorf teacher, parent, and public advocate of the slow learning concept.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's too much pressure on kids to learn their reading, their math, at too early an age? Do you see value in holding that off? Or to compete in today's world, do we need to learn these things early and often? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email talk@WPR.org.
Now, Eric, I want to talk about the pace of the world right now, because as you're well aware, I'm sure, the pace of the world has, at least it seems to have accelerated, because there's so much information that is available at any given moment. Children and families are scheduled often pretty heavily, and it can take a lot just to get through the day and to keep up with everything you need to keep up with. And it's a quick pace. So in light of the skills that a person generally needs to navigate just a single day, how does Waldorf prepare children for the pace of the world and the reality of that?
By helping them slow down. It's, Harvard Graduate School recently called Waldorf education a healing education, and it's really because of that pace. There's a Waldorf school in Silicon Valley that has lots of Google and Apple executives' kids going to it, or employees' kids going to it, and it's because they want to protect their kids from the onslaught of the pressures, as well as the pressures to read and do math and compete, and also the technology. I mean, that's a big part of the pressure of being a parent these days. When you're overscheduled and busy, and you walk into a Barnes & Noble and you see a kiosk displaying little computers that are displayed at a three-year-old's eye level called Leapfrog, that are the bookstore personnel tells you this teaches your child to read and use a computer without any adult intervention. Well, that sounds pretty good to a parent who's beleaguered and is looking for some way to occupy their child, but it's actually the wrong thing to be doing to your child.
You mentioned Apple employees and Barnes & Noble, and in some ways, Apple computers, computers aimed at three-year-olds, those are the hallmarks of a privileged life. Is it just that slow learning works because the parents and the families are privileged?
Well, Waldorf is, I mean, I would love to see it be the basis of education in every school in America. In fact, in Norway, that I mentioned all those Waldorf schools, but Waldorf has influenced the public schools so that kids don't even start school until they're seven in Norway. And it's, as I said, is taking off in China, and it's not just for the privileged. I mean, it's the curriculum is, you know, it happens to be that people who are, it is a private school, but it's, you know, a lot cheaper than most private schools, and I'd love to see it available to everybody. And there's a whole new movement of Waldorf schools that are charter schools in California, but even in Wisconsin, there are some that are opening up.
I want to get to the callers now. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. Let's go first to Monica in Greenfield. Hi, Monica.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I don't know if it is a coincidence, but my experience is very similar to what your guest is saying today. I'm in a bilingual household, and I used to ask my husband to read to my baby. He was really young, and I would tell him, it's important, read to him in English. And my baby would just cry and wail. And I finally gave up. I figured, okay, that's it. with the second one, I didn't try it. And we had their kindergarten teacher was really good and taught me a lot of things to help them with their fine motor coordination and muscles. They are 12 and 14 years old, and I cannot keep enough books in the household. They are avid readers. People have told me, because of your sons, my children are reading. Thank you very much. And I just love it, and I take no credit for it.
Okay, thank you, Monica. And Eric, what would you say to that, her experience with later reading?
Yeah, well, and I think she helped them, by reading and telling stories. It's not just, reading from the page, but it's helping the children cultivate their imaginations and forming pictures and images of what they're hearing. That's the beginning of reading, and that helps a child take delight in the written word later when they're, when they're taking it off the page. But it begins much earlier. In the imagination.
Well, thank you, Monica, for that call. And let's go next to Pat. Pat's with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I think this is a good conversation, and I just want to peel the onion back a little bit more. I guess some would say this kind of shows the success when we can release ourselves from, the restraints of teachers' unions, for example, or potentially there's a big debate now on Common Core. One standard for everybody. And I think in order to make progress, we need to experiment with more of these types of education philosophies. One of the things that I've always read everywhere, where when you have trimesters or year-round school, in other words, instead of a 3 or 4 month summer break, when you start the school days a little bit later, children also perform better. And there seems to be just some obvious things, but for whatever reason, the power structure, I'll call it, vis-a-vis the teachers' unions, politicians, whatever, that's been in place with no competition for hundreds of years, seems to really impede the progress. And I think that's where we need to take this conversation and find out what's really holding our children back from experimenting and learning in different ways, and figure out kind of who we need to remove from the power structure in order to move everyone forward.
Okay, well, thank you, Pat. And Pat, talking about broadening the horizons and experimenting with different learning styles, and I wonder what you think about that, Eric, and also, maybe the public schools could adopt some of the slower learning techniques you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I think, there should be many experiments going on, but people should also recognize that a lot of research has already been done, and the research that shows that approaching reading the way the Waldorf schools do and slow learning is a benefit to the kids is already well established. But there seems to be this idea that getting kids reading before kindergarten, or kindergarten has turned into the new first grade, and there's the pressure starts so early, and I would love it if teachers' unions were advocates for Waldorf education. And part of what I'm trying to do is spread the word broadly, not just to those who already are questioning the system we have now.
All right. Well, thank you, Pat, for the call. And on next to Jacqueline in Madison. Hi there.
Hello. I'm calling just on this point about whether there's an advantage to children for later success by learning to read early. And, I am a Waldorf teacher, I'll admit that, and met Eric a few days ago when he came to a workshop that I was offering. But what caused me to be interested in this point is that I work with young children right now, though I have taught elementary school children in the past. And I kept hearing the idea that if you started children earlier, well, they can do it. Their children are really very cooperative in a way, and they'll do what you ask them to do. So I started to look into whether that helped them. And there just isn't any data to support that. Apparently, there's some advantage that one can see during the first 3 years, but that doesn't last beyond that. And what I think also you take away from the child when you don't let them, through their own exploration and through their own curiosity and their own way of integrating experiences, you take their enthusiasm for learning away from them.
And Jackie, we're going to have to leave it there, Jacqueline. We're just about out of time. Eric, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
There was a people could find out more by going to whywaldorfworks.org. That's a website that lists schools all over the country. And there are lots of Waldorf schools in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, Tamarack, Pine Ridge in Pewaukee, the Madison Waldorf School in Viroqua.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us. We've been speaking with Eric Utney, founder of Utney Magazine.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer of USA Today. We'll hear about congressional reaction to President Obama's proposed budget and testimony from the IRS before a House panel.
First, a bill that would target Common Core education standards in Wisconsin is set for a public hearing tomorrow. If passed, it would create a state academic standards board with the power to review and change educational standards in the state.
Earlier this week, we spoke with Republican State Senator Paul Farrow, one of the legislators behind the bill. Supporters like Farrow say Wisconsin should chart its own course for education as opposed to adopting national standards.
But one of the strongest critics of the bill has been Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Evers. He joins us now to talk about tomorrow's hearing and the challenges facing Common Core. Superintendent Evers, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Let's start with something you wrote in an opinion piece recently. Senate, quoting, Senate Bill 619 is a partisan takeover of the bedrock of schooling, the standards that describe what our kids should know and be able to do in each academic subject area. Talk a little more about what you see as the specific hazards of this bill.
Well, for the first time ever in the state of Wisconsin, we have a bill in front of us that would essentially put the development and writing of standards in the hands of legislators. I know there's committees that are part of this bill and so on and so forth, but frankly, the committees are stacked. And if my recommendation to the legislature is not something they agree to, it automatically goes to the floor of the legislature. And they could be involved with writing those standards right on the floor. And as a grandfather, I will tell you that keeps me up at night. And it's not just limited to English and mathematics, but this commission can also take a look at any of the 23 areas that we have standards in and put that in the legislator's hands. We could be talking about evolution on the floor of the Senate and the Assembly in a few years when we do science standards. I don't believe the people of Wisconsin believe that we want to politicize this process any more than it has been already, and that's why I'm opposed to this bill.
One of the objections that Senator Farrow, among others, has brought up is that these were national standards put together by people from states, governors, and superintendents of education, but promoted by the federal government. They're not reflective of nuances here in Wisconsin. They don't give us the flexibility we need to meet our specific needs in the state. What's wrong with opening things up to tweaking those standards for Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, it's not given to us by the federal government. It was developed by experts from across the country, including Wisconsin experts who are part of that. Then, in addition, when those standards were finally promulgated by at the national level, not the federal level, the national level, those standards were given to the states, and we got input from all sorts of people across the state of Wisconsin, mainly experts in the field and also classroom teachers, and we provided input, and that input was duly noted, and some of those were accepted. So there's the point that Senator Farrow is making there, I just don't buy. First of all, these standards are good. The Wisconsin schools have been implementing them for a couple of years now with pretty good results. And there's nothing to prevent. There's nothing in those standards that dictate what curriculum is going to be used locally, what textbooks are going to be used locally, or how teachers are going to teach to those standards locally. So there's all sorts of opportunities for local implementation strategies that exist and exist now and will exist in the future. this is really all about politics. This is about who's in control and that sort of thing, which bothers me greatly, because this is about, you know, it's impacting children. It's not just being fought out at the state level. It's fought out. It's creating chaotic situations in local schools where they're wondering, what in the world's going on? We're implementing these standards. We're having great success with that. Why now? And why is this being debated now and looking at changing things now?
Let's follow up that question. It seems like there used to be bipartisan, at least maybe support or at least non-objection to the Common Core standards. Why now? What happened to change that apparent consensus over this?
Well, there's been members of the Tea Party across the United States has been very active in being in opposition to the standards, but you know, that's just the weird thing about it. Business, you know, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce, business leaders across the state support it, education groups support it. So now we're in this position of having to kind of debate this going forward. The legislature, in two successive bienniums, created money for us to develop a test that is aligned directly to the Common Core standards. So the same legislators who are now saying, oh my gosh, what's happening? We didn't know anything about this. In the last two sessions, bienniums, have provided money for us to implement this. It seems ironic, and you know, the governor also has been supportive of the Common Core state standards in the read-to-lead task force that we both worked on. The final report praised the going forward with the Common Core standards. So clearly, the political climate has changed. We're moving into an election season, and people are looking for votes.
Some of the arguments from people in the Tea Party, as you mentioned, were that, as you said earlier, this was put together by experts nationally and here in the state of Wisconsin, by people in the field of the schools. Not enough, they say, public input, not enough citizen input into what these standards look like. Do you buy that?
No, these standards were open for public comment for a long time, and before they were adopted I adopted that in 2010. So no, and to be honest with you, this isn't like writing legislation that adopting the Common Core. This is what's being taught in schools. So it's not. Yes, we did things, but frankly, every one of the 424 school districts in the state had discussions around this issue. So it probably had more widespread support than this bill. I mean, this bill hasn't even had a hearing, and they're calling us out on not being transparent. I don't buy it. 424 school districts in the state have been embracing this and involving their parents in it right from the get-go. I've gone across the state. I was elected twice on this platform. So transparency isn't the issue. Politics is.
Well, Senator Farrow said this is just creating a mechanism to maybe alter the Common Core standards. It might be that the committee meets and signs off on Common Core as it is or makes some minor changes. Is that really that big a problem?
Yeah, a fat chance that'll happen. The author of this bill, Senator Vukmir, made it clear from day one that the purpose of this bill, this commission, and this particular procedure is to get rid of the Common Core. I take her at her word.
So if this passes, how do you see the education system changing in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it'll be a sad day. We've had conversations across this country, and people are looking to Wisconsin to do the right thing. I'm fearful that this will send the wrong message to our business community. Certainly, it's going to send the wrong message to our kids that these standards that they've been working on with some success, we're going to have to now start from scratch. I think it could make us look bad across the state and could make us look bad across the country. When our business community is asking us to step forward and make sure our kids are college and career ready, we step up to the plate, and then all of a sudden we have to backtrack. That is going to send the wrong message to not only the Wisconsinites, but to the United States of America.
Superintendent Evers, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much, Rob.
That's Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. We talked with him about the challenge to Common Core standards in Wisconsin. Yesterday, President Obama sent his $3.9 trillion budget to Congress. It's being called a populist wish list by the New York Times.
And tempers erupted this morning at a congressional hearing on the alleged IRS targeting of Tea Party groups.
Also, hours later, the Senate rejected its first nominee from President Obama since they changed their approval rules last November.
Joining us now is Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Veronica?
Pretty well. So before we get to President Obama's budget, from what I understand, there was some shouting, some tempers going on in Congress this morning after a former IRS official pleaded the fifth on questions about the IRS targeting Tea Party groups. Fill us in on what happened.
Well, the deal was this is the official at the sort of center of this branch of the IRS that oversaw tax-exempt organizations. And as your listeners no doubt remember, the big scandal erupted last year when they admitted that they had delayed tax-exempt status for a bunch of political groups, most of which had Tea Party or something like it in their name. And a year ago, this woman, Lois Lerner, took the fifth and said she wasn't going to testify on Capitol Hill at a hearing because she might incriminate herself. The problem was, she then answered one question in that hearing when they said, well, is this a real document? She said, that's my understanding of this real document, but I'm not testifying. The committee believes that when she answered that one question, she waived her rights to say that she wouldn't answer questions. So they called her back today and marched her through it again, and she answered it to every question. I will not answer questions. I will not answer questions. And the committee, basically the chairman, Daryl Issa, slams the gavel and says, okay, fine, we're not getting anywhere. We're going to close this hearing and we're going to end the hearing and we'll talk about contempt proceedings. Meanwhile, the Democrats said, hey, wait, we want to talk. But the chairman said, never mind, we're done here. And the Republicans all got up and started to leave the room. So the Democrats start chanting, shame, 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 let us talk. You know, this is political theater at its best. It was a circus. Ultimately, we learned absolutely nothing more about the Tea Party scandal than we knew yesterday, but it was fun to watch.
So Republicans are saying that to them, she waived her right to plead the fifth, even though she's pleading the fifth again. She's not answering questions. Is there a mechanism in place in Congress that can force her to testify?
Yeah, they could try to bring her up on charges of contempt of Congress, which, you know, that becomes actually a criminal proceeding at some point. It's hard to do. It would require, you know, the committee to vote on those charges and move from there. You know, what's interesting here is that the lawyer, after this hearing was over, her lawyer said, look, we were trying to negotiate a deal with the Republicans by which we would testify, but our sense was in the end it was simply a ploy to vilify us on television. And so I advised my client to instead repeat her Fifth Amendment rights. It's really interesting.
What kind of line is Lois Lerner walking right now as far as testifying goes?
Well, you know, it's a tough legal question, right? I mean, she's no longer in the government. She's a private citizen now. And she is saying that she puts herself in jeopardy. There are other investigations, including, I believe, FBI investigations of exactly what went on. Lois Lerner has also had personal threats against her, once her name became public. You know, she's in a very tenuous position all around, and it does not necessarily do her any good, and certainly her lawyer would tell you this, doesn't do her any good to go sit in front of Congress and let them treat her like a piñata in front of the cameras.
Is the hope from the GOP that she will be forced to testify and that her words will somehow implicate the White House?
Probably. I mean, I don't mean to put intention in their minds. I think part of their intention is to keep this story alive. Clearly, Republicans believe that this was a White House orchestrated effort to punish the political opponents of the Obama administration. The White House and the Democrats would tell you that that is absurd. It was a bureaucratic bungling, of course, but not in any way motivated from the White House. I think to some degree, the Republicans are looking for testimony that would help make their case, but they're also, you know, an event like today was unnecessary. The only reason to really do it is to bring this story back up into the press.
So Republicans say that they're going to talk contempt charges. They adjourned, sounds like, and that's what they said they were going to be talking about. How soon could something like that happen?
I don't really know. And my suspicion is now we go back to, you know, remember, this second appearance before the committee took almost a year to materialize. This could go on for a while. My suspicion is they'll have some more negotiations with the lawyer and see if they can work something out. Maybe they'll try to go for contempt proceedings sometime, you know, in a few months. I just don't know the timing of it.
Well, let's move on to President Obama's budget, which he sent yesterday. It's a $3.5 trillion plan. Yep. The New York Times called it a populist witch list. What are some of the major things that he's asking for?
Well, you know, he's asking for an expansion of the earned income tax credit for more lower income people to be able to take advantage of that. He's looking for a major investment in early childhood education and some workforce investment kind of things. He is looking to cap some corporate tax rates close some corporate loopholes, tax loopholes. He, at one point or another, had talked about possibly changing the way Social Security cost of living adjustments are made in order to save a little money. That went out the window this year. But, you know, this is all a theoretical exercise. This is now a political document, not a budget document. I mean, it's not, no one expects this to be implemented. They've already got a budget agreement for this year and next year based on the deal that Congress struck earlier this year. So, this is really just an opportunity for the president to say, this is my agenda, this is the Democratic agenda, this is what we believe in, never mind whether it actually ever gets implemented.
And apparently there was some pressure on him to submit a budget just like this, and from the looks of what he submitted, he's blowing past any conciliatory checkpoints, and it seems as though what he's asking for, and what he said he's asking for, is to signal a budget that favors upward mobility and the middle class. But could any of this actually get through Congress?
Well, you know, you can't necessarily blame him for blowing past any, sense of sort of bipartisan cooperation, because there was really no format in which there was going to be a discussion anyway. There's no place to go to have that conversation. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, the White House said, look, we don't have a debate partner, a dance partner, I think they called it, on deficit issues. You know, we'd like to have a sort of a broader discussion about, entitlements and sort of long-term spending and stuff, but we just don't, there's no way to get at it because the Republicans don't really want to talk about it. And frankly, at the moment, I don't think the Democrats do either. Everybody's happier just doing sort of posturing. So yeah, I mean, there actually are some things in here that they could agree on. I mean, I think they're, Dave Camp, the Ways and Means Committee chairman, today was talking about the tax plan that he likes, and some of that does actually match up with the president's lowering some of the top tax rates, maybe not so much, but cutting some of the corporate loopholes they could probably agree on. Even expanding the earned income tax credit they might be able to agree on. So, you know, there are bits and pieces of this that could be bipartisan, but there's just no format in which to have that discussion at this point.
So you call this a political document at this point, and I think the New York Times wrote that it could actually be, a campaigning document. That's what it could be used for at this point. So what could its potential impact be?
Well, I mean, budgetarily, nothing. But in a campaign circumstance, this is where Democrats get to go up and say, the Republicans want to shut down your government, want to give away tax breaks to the rich. Democrats want to do this stuff. Democrats want to, expand government support for education. We want to expand tax credits for the poor. We want to crack down on corporations. So, it's hard to know what the impact on that is because, we don't know the outcome of these elections, but the impact, if nothing else, is this becomes our talking point. This becomes our agenda item.
And let's move on to one last thing before we let you go today. President Obama was blocked by the Senate earlier today when his nominee to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice was rejected by the Senate.
Yep.
And I wonder if you could talk us through what happened with that rejection.
Yeah, very interesting, in fact. The Democrats knew this was going to be a close vote on this guy whose name is Debo Degbola. They knew it was going to be a close vote because Degbola, no one doubts he's a very qualified civil rights lawyer. But a few years ago, he got involved in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who mm-hmm. may be familiar to some of your listeners. Free Mumia movement has rattled among the left wing for 30 years. He is a black activist who was convicted of killing a police officer in Philadelphia in 1980-something, 81, I think. And he's been in jail, and he's on death row. And Adegbole was part of a team that convinced the courts to commute his sentence from death to life in prison. And law enforcement groups and a lot of Republicans are furious and have always been furious and believe that this is injustice for a police officer, basically. So they mounted a campaign against Adegbole, and they won. The Democrats knew it was going to be close. They had Joe Biden in the chair presiding over this vote to cast the tie-breaking vote if it got there. But they were still a vote short, and they couldn't even get to a tie. And so
they must have known this was going to be an issue. They vet their candidates thoroughly. They just thought they had the numbers to push it through, it sounds like.
And I think people underestimated the backlash this would create, including among Democrats, and particularly Democrats from the Pennsylvania area. I mean, the two of the Democrats who were critical here were Casey, who's a Pennsylvania senator, and Coons, who's a Delaware senator who's right nearby. They had no choice because the movement around Philadelphia suburbs particularly is so strong.
All right, and we'll leave it there. Paul, thank you so much for joining us, as always.
My pleasure, Veronica. We'll talk to you again.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us every week at this time to share the ins and outs of the United States Congress.